The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, offering care in 30 locations across northern New England and in your community. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. Dartmouth-Hitchcock.org.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This summer, the VA Medical Center, the hospital that veterans in southern New Hampshire rely on, seemed to be humming along like any other hospital. At least it appeared that way if you were looking at their performance metrics. For a group operating on the inside, however, things looked different.
I know this sounds strange, but it's like flying.
That's Dr. Ed Coyce. He's a physician at the Manchester VA, and as it turns out, one of a team of whistleblowers, physicians who raised concerns about the quality of care at the VA.
I learned how to fly on a dirt strip, and one of the things you learn is you always want to have the horizon. You want to orient where you are. And when you lose the horizon, like if you go into a cloud or it becomes dark, that's when flying gets very difficult and you have to use your instruments. And sometimes you have to fly completely by your instruments. Now, if your instruments are accurate, you can do that. But if the instruments are not accurate and you've lost the horizon, you crash or you have problems. The metrics are very similar to your instruments. If you have accurate metrics, then you can fly without seeing the horizon. And I think what happened with Schlosser and with Oker and RVA is that they lost sight of the horizon. And they were flying by metrics that they thought they were doing a good job. We had 4 stars, but we were providing bad care.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today is Veterans Day, an opportunity to express our gratitude to the men and women who've served this country. It's also a chance to listen to people who've spoken out about the challenges of life after military service. And a warning here that we are going to hear a frank account of sexual assault that might not be suitable for all listeners. It has been a turbulent year for one institution caring for New Hampshire vets, and the past few months have been full of news for New Hampshire veterans. The state's only VA medical center in Manchester has met with scandal, disaster, and a full helping of public outrage. Peter Biello is with me. He is NHPR's host of All Things Considered, and he covers veterans' issues for NHPR. Peter, who is this Ed Coyce we just heard from?
Ed Coyce is the head of spine care at the Manchester VA, and he has worked for decades with patients with spinal issues. He spent most of his career in private practice and came to the VA almost out of retirement, in a way, to serve in a new way. He's got these mutton chops. He's easily to pick out at a crowd. He's got this great, boisterous laugh. He's a super friendly guy, and he's sort of emerged as the leader of these of this whistleblower crew, in part just because he's got this real, genuine passion for helping veterans and cutting through the bureaucracy, which he found kind of shocking. He found this bureaucracy kind of shocking, having worked in the private sector for years and years and being able to sort of be the king of his domain at his private practice.
So he's among how many whistleblowers?
12 now. It was 11 at the time, but it's 12 now.
Who were these doctors and what was motivating them?
They were motivated by their patients and by what they were seeing. They were all in different specialties. You know, there was surgery, there was cardiology, and there was a former chief of staff among them. So they came from different disciplines, but they all had different examples of how the Manchester VA was in some ways putting money and budget over what the patients actually needed. That was sort of the overarching concern. They couldn't get X piece of equipment because money. They couldn't send a patient to Y doctor because money. And that was a problem. They were all very upset about that.
What was Dr. Coyce noticing specifically?
He had a lot of patients with a condition called myelopathy, which, if you leave it untreated, can paralyze you, can leave you in a wheelchair. And that's what was happening to some patients. They weren't getting the proper care that they needed.
And this is a treatable condition?
It's a very treatable condition. You know, if you catch it early, you can provide some treatment and you won't progress.
So he and a group of doctors went to the VA internally and complained. What was their complaint?
Their complaint was that the patients weren't getting the care that they needed. They weren't getting the equipment that they needed, and that there were flies in the operating room, and that the operating room occasionally had to be shut down so that they could sanitize and get rid of the fly problem. But the fly problem had existed for a decade, and they just kept, you know, moving the patients out, cleaning up, bringing them back in, and then the flies would reappear, and it was not a great situation. When these whistleblowers complained, among the complaints, Dr. Coyce had a list of 96 patients, and these 96 patients had myelopathy in various stages. So as he reported to the internal VA system, the Office of Medical Inspector looked into these patients, or said that they did, and in the report that they first came back with, said that, you know, they looked really carefully at two of those patients. Those patients were fine. The other 94 are fine too. And Dr. Coyce was sort of flabbergasted by that, because he knew that among those 94 patients, there were some gentlemen in there who really suffered unnecessarily. And so he was very upset with that OMI report.
So, as he said, referring to the plain instruments, the metrics look okay.
Yeah, assuming that they did look, and there's some question in Dr. Coyce's mind about whether or not they looked at those 94 patients, but even if they did, they would be looking at the charts, right? They would be looking at these patients' charts. Dr. Coyce is saying that's not enough, because you really need to talk to these patients and find out how these conversations with their doctors went, so you can figure out how a patient's situation can get so bad and still be undetectable in the charts.
Okay, so OMI says, not so bad, not as bad as you thought. Then they go to the Boston Globe Spotlight team. How did they get in touch with them?
Well, an anonymous person got in touch with Boston Globe and said, you should call Ed Coyce. So they called Ed Coyce, and Ed talked to them, and they agreed to take on the story and really start investigating, and it took quite a while.
That sort of blew things open on the VA. Two executives were fired or had to resign?
Well, they were moved. That's Daniel Oker and James Schlosser. They were not fired. In fact, they were moved down to sort of the New England headquarters in Bedford, and recently this week it was reported that James Schlosser is working as a physician at the Tilton community-based outpatient clinic. So they're still on the payroll at the VA, last I heard. One other person was removed. That was, I believe, the chief of nursing, Carol Williams. She is no longer with the VA. And that happened, Carol Williams was removed when VA Secretary David Shulkin made a visit to Manchester to address this stuff.
The federal secretary.
Yeah, the federal secretary came all the way to New Hampshire to sort of meet with the whistleblowers and meet with staff at the Manchester VA and figure out what is happening here. I mean, he's based in D.C. He's going to have a bird's eye view of the entire system. So to come down to the hospital level here and see what's happening was a significant move. And so he came, and he, to some extent, played it down the middle. Like he said of Schlosser and Oker, you know, these are good people, but sometimes a hospital needs a change. Because, again, it comes down to metrics. You know, it comes down to, it could possibly be true that James Schlosser and Daniel Oker did everything by the book. But is the book itself representative of the best practices for treating veterans and giving them health care?
So what do you think, as a reporter, looking at how the VA has responded, and how are veterans that you spoke to on the ground responding themselves?
As far as the VA's response, the VA is doing what responsible bureaucracies do, which is they are taking steps to analyze what happened. And none of that is quick, right? I mean, they can't, in general, just fire someone based on allegations. They have to investigate. So that's what they're doing. They're investigating that. When Secretary Shulkin was here in August, he ordered for the creation of a task force that will look at the future of healthcare for veterans in New Hampshire. It's the VA New Hampshire Vision 2025 Task Force.
So an internal task force.
Yep, but the nice thing about this task force is that it does have some members of the community. Dave Kenny, for example, is not a VA employee, but he's co-chair. He's chair of the State Veterans Advisory Committee, super active in the state veterans community. And he's knowledgeable. So to have community members on this task force, I think, is a helpful thing for the VA to bring that outside perspective. So they're going to make recommendations, this task force, by January 1st. Meanwhile, the VA is investigating James Schlosser and Daniel Oker to see exactly what happened with that. And as far as veterans and what they have to say about the Manchester VA, I'm not sure. I don't know if this has changed the minds of anybody about veterans. Veterans have a very individual relationship with the VA. Either they've had they could have had a great relationship with their doctors there and great experience. And if all this other stuff is happening, it may not affect them at all. They may be able to get in and out of the Manchester VA and get their appointments and no problems at all. And then there are some, and you see these folks at town hall meetings, which the VA holds regularly, not just when there's a crisis. They have grievance, and they take it very personally, and they really want this grievance, whatever it may be, to be made right. As far as I have heard, no one has changed their opinion about the Manchester VA, but this may serve to sort of reinforce what they already believe.
How about the whistleblowers? How do they feel about progress, and are they optimistic that things are going to improve?
Dr. Coyce, the whistleblower with whom I speak most regularly, he is worried about the new investigation being conducted by the Office of Medical Inspector because he didn't have much faith in the first investigation.
I know you spent a lot of time at those town hall meetings this summer listening to what veterans were saying, coming forward with even different and other concerns about the VA. What kinds of concerns were they raising?
Some of them raised really global concerns. I remember one on the seacoast. This was the last town hall meeting that I was able to go to where both James Schlosser and Danielle Oker were there. And one gentleman stood up and he made a comment about asking for a particular piece of equipment that he believed he needed. And the answer from the VA right away was a no. And he was disappointed that the VA wouldn't work with him to find a way to get to yes. Now, whether he actually needed that piece of equipment, I can't say. But he's talking about the culture in general, and I think that was an interesting perspective on it, especially because the new interim director of the Manchester VA, he's been stressing, you know, how do we get to yes? You know, how do we work around some of this, the stuff that prevents patients from getting what they think they need? So his approach is different, and it seems like he's getting good marks from both the whistleblowers. I can't speak for all of them, but the ones I've spoken to seem happy with his approach. The congressional delegation seems happier with his approach. It seems like he's making progress there, and that may be in part because of his approach to trying to get to yes.
There's another story that I just couldn't get out of my head that you reported on, a story that we had maybe not heard about, something that veterans are concerned about.
One of the people who came forward at one of the town hall meetings immediately following the Boston Globe report in July was Cindy McGurk. She's a veteran who spoke in detail about military sexual trauma that she experienced when she was serving. And in the course of discussing what she had gone through, she laid out some concrete things that she thought needed to change at the Manchester VA.
I mean, at this point, was this a topic whistleblowers were talking about?
This was not a thing that the whistleblowers had been talking about, but it's the most concrete example of veterans taking advantage of the situation, the opportunity, I guess you could say, to make their mark of improvement on the Manchester VA, because that's what everybody's looking at right now, how to improve the services. So Cindy McGurk stood up, told her story, and said the VA needs to do a better job in Manchester caring for women veterans. So after I heard her talk at this town hall meeting in July, I invited her to the studio here in Concord to talk in detail about what she went through and what she wants to see change at the Manchester VA.
So I'll wear my headphones briefly just to...
Have you ever been in there?
I have not.
It's a little bit bigger than this.
The women's health place is just about as bigger than the studio?
Yeah, a little bit bigger than this.
And it's not a big studio, by the way. It's very, very small with the studio that we were in. She had been getting her medical care at the VA for many years. She'd served 4 years in the Army during Desert Storm.
I was Ranger support, and we were in the field most of the time. There weren't very many of us females. And I had gotten gang raped a couple of times a week for 2 years. And when I told, they demoted me, they took my rank, and they put me on extra duty with the people that had sexually assaulted me.
And she said that, you know, when she brought this to the attention of her superiors, that military sexual trauma was just not something that they wanted to talk about.
They weren't going to do anything. I was going to be in huge trouble, and I was. I had to take a toothbrush and scrub one of the colonel's offices that raped me while he sat there and berated me the whole time. I felt dehumanized. I felt like garbage. I felt unworthy, and that something I did had to have caused what was going on with me. And they had said that had I not put makeup on or tried to look nice, and if I wasn't pretty, that would have happened.
Boy, that's just harrowing.
It was difficult to hear.
I mean, I realize that in recent weeks, the floodgates have sort of opened, right, on stories of sexual assault, harassment. This kind of level of violence is so difficult to hear. And she was talking about decades ago. Who was listening? Nobody was listening, it seems.
She did speak out, and she didn't get justice at the time. And what that left her with was severe trauma and PTSD.
I did great at first when I came out, and then PTSD just hit me like a ton of bricks. Combat PTSD is talked about. Wounded warriors are talked about. But nobody talks about us.
The women's clinic was on the sixth floor of the medical center, and she would have to ride the elevator of a small confined space with lots of guys who either have the build or the look of having served in the military. Mm.
I know that, of course, I'm safe, but the PTSD side of my mind puts me on alert, makes me feel sick to my stomach. This needs to be talked about instead of swept under the rug. Losing half of our lives, you can't get that back. But you can't let it define you either. And being broken, I know that I'll never get whole again, but I try to stop and see the little things. My kids, my husband, and the fact that hopefully by speaking out, something will change.
So, Peter, Cindy has been speaking out. She spoke up at that town hall. She spoke to you about these issues. Has anything changed?
Yeah. After the report I wrote about Cindy came out in early October, New Hampshire's congressional delegation signed a letter to Al Montoya, interim director at the Manchester VA, asking him to change a few things that Cindy was hoping would be changed at the Manchester VA. Cindy wanted a separate entrance for women, for the women's clinic, which is common in new VAs. That's actually something that the VA wants to have. They want it to be on the first floor, and they want an expanded space. They want it to be bigger and better and designed so that women can feel safe and have the resources that they need to get their health care. And so I asked Al Montoya about whether or not he plans to follow up on the congressional delegations and Cindy's request. And he said, yes, they're working on a plan to move the women's clinic at the Manchester VA from the 6th floor to the 1st and get it a separate entrance. Now, if that plan is approved, it's still going to take years, but it's better than a no.
Hmm.
Better than a no.
And it must mean so much for Cindy to feel like she's been heard.
I sent her a message after I heard, and she was just delighted. She was delighted to hear that this is bringing about a positive change.
I am the proud daughter of World War II veteran Robert Prescott, who, like many of his contemporaries, did not talk about what he did or saw during his service. That has changed somewhat, but still, for a lot of veterans, the most comfortable place to hang out and talk is with other vets. I dropped by the VFW in Concord to ask the late afternoon crowd about how they would like to be acknowledged this Veterans Day.
I think a lot of people just don't think about how our vets are being treated at all.
Most of the people just want to ask, how many people did you kill?
Ask them about their day. You got to talk to them. Yes, you can thank them for serving. But, I mean, and a lot of them don't want to talk about what they've done.
Okay, so say I meet you for the first time and find out you're a veteran. What would you like me to say to you?
Welcome home.
Welcome home, good Louis. Happy hour at the Concord VFW. I spoke with Lori Walsh. Bartender Karen, Dave, and Louis declined to give their last names. But Louis did say he's good Louis. There's another guy they call bad Louis. Stay with us for Only in New Hampshire, coming up right after the break. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. When I was growing up, you know, the drinking age for my older brothers and sisters was 18. My father smoked cigarettes, right?
Or smoking was still good for you.
Still good for you. And we used to ride our bikes without helmets.
You could hitchhike.
Hitchhiking. Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine?
With the cops.
Yep. Can you imagine kids doing that now?
Airplanes? No rules for airplanes whatsoever.
you could just walk on.
If you wanted to fly, you probably could if you asked nicely.
But nowhere in the United States would you be pulled over for not wearing a seatbelt. So when did that change?
Where this starts is in 1984, New York was the first state to pass a law that required everybody to wear their seatbelts. And most other states followed within a couple years. And in a relatively short period of time, we went from no laws on the books to pretty much every state had a law that said, you know, if you're an adult, you have to wear your seatbelt.
How many people were wearing seatbelts back then?
In the early 80s, the numbers that we do have, around 14% of people wore their seatbelts.
Wow.
Which is not very many. So not many people were wearing seatbelts. Within like a decade after all these laws passed, that number was up around 60%,
mm-hmm.
and today it's around 90%. So we've gone from 14 to 90, which is an incredible change. It went from being something that nobody really knew about to now all of a sudden everybody knows that seatbelts save lives. You know, they're incredibly effective. And that's a pretty tremendous shift.
Yeah, and now it's a habit. I mean, I don't know too many people who get in a car, you shut the door, you just click on your seatbelt.
It's not quite universal. There is one state that does not have a law anywhere on the books that requires adults to wear their seatbelts.
Let me guess, New Hampshire.
It's New Hampshire.
Well, Word of Mouth, we did this series called Only in New Hampshire and answer your questions about things that you wonder about or come across while living in this state. Producer Ben Henry is with me. He's been looking to something that really is only in New Hampshire. No seatbelt law.
No law. Nothing on the books.
Has that always been true? I mean, did no one ever try and pass a law?
There have been a couple times when the legislature has introduced bills to that effect. And each time they've been shot down. Most recently was 2009. There was a bill introduced into the state house and it got shot down. You know, everybody agrees that seatbelts are incredibly effective, and you should wear your seatbelt. Nobody really just, there's no real anti-seatbelt lobby at this point. But people will say, it's just not the government's job to make you wear your seatbelt, that this is your own choice. And, you know, we have a right to do risky stuff. And, you know, New Hampshire has a libertarian streak. We just decided, you know, we don't want that law. As a result of never having one of these laws, people in this state do not wear their seatbelt as much as people in other states. Fewer people in New Hampshire wear their seatbelt, in fact, than any other state.
So what percentage are we talking about?
The national average is 90% of people wear their seatbelt. In New Hampshire, it's 70% of people. So it's still a solid majority, but substantially fewer people here. And, you know, 2009 was the last time we really had this public discussion, and I wanted to know how people felt about it now. Do people still feel strongly that the government shouldn't be in the business of telling people, you know, to buckle their seatbelts? So I spent an afternoon in Concord, walking around, hanging out in a parking lot, and asking people. Do you wear your seatbelt?
Of course.
All the time?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know. Habit? Safety?
Okay.
We wear ours all the time. We taught our kids to do that even when they were little. And they still put their seatbelts on all the time. I think it's just a wise measure, you know, for your own safety.
I wear it every day, all the time.
All the time?
Yes. Just because I have grandchildren and they watch what I do.
Yeah. You guys wear your seatbelts?
Yes.
You both wear your seatbelts all the time?
My car beeps at me if I don't, so yeah.
Fair enough.
Mine doesn't beep and I still wear it.
You're shaking your head. You don't wear your seatbelt. Why is that?
Laziness. It's very hard to get it pulled around. It's hard to get it to click in. And it's worse to try to get it off.
When my grandchildren aren't in the car, I don't sometimes.
Okay.
I'm a rebel.
Well, I never liked wearing them. I was in a wreck one time, and my sister was driving. The car was totaled, and we didn't even get a bruise or a scratch.
Were you wearing your seatbelt?
No.
You might know New Hampshire is the only state in the whole country where it's not legally required that you wear your seatbelt. You can't get a ticket for it. What do you think about that?
I think it's fine. I think that, you know, state motto and all.
The state motto being?
Live free or die.
I think children should be required to do it, but as adults, I mean, they're adults and they should, you know, it's their own decision to make.
New Hampshire does have that reputation for being the live free or die state, you know.
I think it would be up to the individual person. Mm-hmm. I don't think it should be mandatory.
Mm-hmm. So you would probably oppose a seatbelt law?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Okay.
Live free or die, man. Just the way it is. And if you're foolish enough not to wear seatbelts or not wear helmets, it's all up to you.
I'm okay with it being a personal choice. But if they did make it a law, it wouldn't bother me since it's what I practice anyways. So.
I mean, would I be marching in front of the state house in protest of a law that said that you should have to wear your seatbelt? No. But, you know, if it was a ballot item, would I say that people have to wear their seatbelt? No, I wouldn't. I would vote that down.
Well, it's interesting that you say you kind of want that to be your prerogative to tell your children how, you know, what's safe and what's not safe, but not necessarily the government's job.
Exactly.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you for sharing. I really appreciate
it.
Yeah, have a good day.
Oftentimes when people do things for their own good, they're wagging their fingers at other people who aren't. And I didn't hear that. What I heard here is, no, I use my seatbelt all the time, but I don't think it should be a law.
Yeah, you know, it's a pretty fundamental question about what role the government should play in our lives. Whether, you know, when you have something like this that we all know it's a good idea and there's no reason not to wear your seatbelt, there's still a question of whether or not the government should be in the business of enforcing that kind of common sense rule. And I heard the state motto a lot. I think it's very familiar and, you know, it's powerful. For one thing, it's a dramatic phrase, right? Live free or die. It's an ultimatum. I think just because we grow up seeing it everywhere and people really internalize that and, you know, when you have to answer, you know, big important questions, it's really helpful to have a sweeping motto like that that seems to encapsulate everything and to answer every question in the same way.
So what I'm wondering is, do New Hampshire's looser seatbelt laws and correspondingly all those unbuckled drivers, does that lead to more injuries and fatalities?
That's a good question, and I looked into that, and the answer is no, not really. Traffic fatalities in New Hampshire are actually below the national average.
Huh. Well, any idea why?
That's another good question, and to answer it, I had to call in some backup. I talked to Russ Rader at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, which is a nonprofit that does research on traffic fatalities. And I asked him that exact question. Given that people in New Hampshire don't buckle up as much, why don't we have higher fatalities compared to other states?
When you look at fatality rates state by state, you see the highest rates tend to be in the Midwest and West, where you have fewer urban areas, greater expanses of distances on more dangerous two-lane high-speed rural roads. You don't have those vast expanses of space in New Hampshire, and your population density tends to be concentrated in the southern half of the state near urban areas. So the roads are less hazardous in New Hampshire than they are in many other states.
So, Russ, I've been talking with residents here about this exact problem. And there have been times in the past where we introduced bills that would require people to wear their seatbelts. A lot of people say, you know, it just shouldn't be the government's job to make people wear their seatbelts. I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, it works. And, you know, the motto, live free or die, may be ingrained in the culture of New Hampshire, but people are dying needlessly because of lack of belt use. And we could be saving a lot of lives if people were required to buckle up.
Okay, Ben, do you use your seatbelt? Ooh, long pause. I think we have our answer.
I do wear my seatbelt all the time.
Every time. Okay. Thank you so much for your work on this.
You are welcome.
Stay with us for some music and conversation with the Portland-based holler folk trio, The Ghost of Paul Revere. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from NHPR. Is there anything more refreshing than hearing a classic song done in a new way? Here's one we found.
Out here in the field, I fight for my meal.
I get my... That's The Who's Baba O'Reilly, given new life by the ghost of Paul Revere. The Portland, Maine-based trio, we're told, also does a memorable cover of Snoop Dogg's Gin and Juice. The band does plenty of its own tunes, too, all with a rambunctious mix of bluegrass, folk, and traditional gospel that has been dubbed holler folk. Here's a little sample. That's Little Bird from the Ghost of Paul Revere's new album, Monarch. They're going to be playing at 3S Art Space tonight. That's Saturday, November 11th at 9 o'clock. And we have a pair of the ghosts, Sean McCarthy. He's singer and bassist. Hello, Sean.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm just fine. Glad to be talking with you. And singer and banjo player Max Davis. Hello, Max.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. You know, I read some places you guys are a quartet or a trio. Which is it?
Well, I'd say at the core we're a trio. It's myself and it's Max and our best friend and guitar player Griffin. We kind of make up the ghost, but we definitely have got a rotating cast of characters we love to play with.
Well, we get a little taste of that foot stomping and hooting on that song, Little Bird. But you grew up in Maine, and that's kind of a place that I think of as, you know, where classic rock rules, at least on the radio. How did you find your way to holler folk?
Well, we were a little confused as to how to label the music that we were making, and couldn't really fit into traditional bluegrass as a genre kind of specific title for us. We definitely have that bluegrass kind of instrumentation, but at the same time, we were really influenced by rock and roll and kind of R&B and just anything that we were hearing.
So you made up holler folk?
We did.
So you guys grew up together, right?
Yep. Max and Griffin met each other when they were 2 years old, and then I came along and joined the gang when we were all three. So it's been the past 27 years, I guess.
Good thing all you can sing, huh?
Yeah, that was a nice surprise.
I guess if somebody couldn't harmonize, they didn't make it into your little club.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. We all have kind of iconic and different voices, but found out, I guess, around high school that they all worked really well together. And I think a big part of it was just the fact that we had known each other for so long. And it was something similar to that kind of family band situation where you know how that person phrases certain things or how they will kind of talk or what their response will be, which lended itself to the blend. And then I think from there it started to become more about the organization of the notes within the chords that we were harmonizing.
Well, you guys have been New England Music Award winners. You played the Newport Folk Festival. Your first album was on Billboard's Northeast chart, so big success, big following. And since then, you put out an EP and now Monarch, this second album, which to me sounds a little more complex. There's more layered instruments. How is it different for you all?
In the past, we've always gone about our, I think, songwriting and recording, looking at it as a live piece, kind of, where we'd all kind of jump in together and we'd record all at the same time. And this time, however, we wanted to try and do something a little different and push ourselves and get outside of our realm of comfortability. We wanted to try and make an album that we couldn't necessarily do live, at least not easily. Something that would challenge us, I think, too, was a big part of it.
Well, let's hear a song from the record. This is called Montreal.
Snow softly falling in the cold, this quietness is growing old. Try to find the words to say, I never hoped to go down this way. So easy does it easy now, taste the blood inside my mouth. I said easy does it easy now, really hope we work it out. Are we growing apart? Are we growing up? Are we in a dream? Or are we waking up?
Are we growing up or are we growing apart? Are we stuck in a dream or are we waking up? Some pretty big questions there. So what's going on for you guys?
Ooh, good question. I think just growing up is a big part of it, and kind of making that jump from a young adult to a land of a little more experience and the hard lessons that can come in those in-between years.
It wasn't really planned when we were doing the writing for the album for Monarch, but kind of, and we didn't have the name Monarch kind of picked out, but we definitely, after had kind of assembled the songs, realized that a lot of the thematic kind of songwriting and then also sonically, it was a lot about transition. It was a lot about coming from one place and the kind of hard moments that then shape you into the person that you're going to become. And so it was a lot about kind of where we thought we were going and kind of what life kind of throws at you as curveballs and then how you kind of advance from there, I would say.
So I'm thinking for a band that started when you're all 20-somethings and the things you need, the things you're attracted to and think you're supposed to have, it's pretty different as we age. So what does that mean, not just for you individually, but for a band of friends who've known each other since you're kids? Or do you feel like you're all going through this kind of changes together?
It seems like it. I know we all get dealt different hands in life, but it could also be the fact that we've got each other to lean back on and to look for support from, too, when one of us were going through a hard time, even though it was their hard time to go through. The other two of us were there, at least in a satellite capacity, to help in any way we can. So it never felt like we were going through anything completely alone.
So where are you now? Are you in that caterpillar, chrysalis stage, butterfly alighting on a tree branch? Where are you?
I feel like we're in the chrysalis right now. But life is a funny thing in that same way that Sean was talking about. You know, I don't think none of us had really planned to try and make music a living. We found solace in it, and we enjoyed kind of playing together, and we knew that. And then we started to see that other people started to enjoy the music that we were playing when we were enjoying playing it together. And now it's kind of at this point where we are making a living out of it and trying to grow it and expand it, but it's always that, it's a funny amorphous kind of stage of where we're going dynamically as people, especially having, you know, being with two other people that you've been with your entire life. It's very rare, I think, to see three people that aren't blood related but have shared a majority of their lives together and experiences together.
So you haven't hit that, like, behind the music stage where you start plotting against each other and begging to get out of this little threesome?
No, we have board games for that.
Your lives are moving on, but there's something particularly New England feeling about this song. It's called Welcome Home. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Hey, you cut down this old family tree. Is this awkward silence 'cause of me? Hey, what happened to your wedding? Terrified of what your silence brings. Welcome home. Welcome home.
You all are from Portland, you know, a place that of a lot of New England towns has changed dramatically in the past decade or so. Do you still feel welcome when you go home?
110%.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think It's kind of a funny thing. The geography does change quite a bit when you are away from it for so long. And also your friends and your family change when you come back. But there is something to be said about the New England kind of mentality or, you know, the kind of personalities. It's an incredible group of people. They're all very hardworking and a lot of times stoic, but a very strong community. And we always have felt that the community that's there for us will always be there for us.
So I've read a lot of reviews that have compared you to the Abbott Brothers, to Mumford and Sons, and also some saying you're a mix of bluegrass, folk, and gospel for the millennial generation. So what does that mean to you? Like you're best with fermented foods or wearing skinny jeans or something?
God, I hope not. The whole millennial generation thing, I still don't really know what that means, but it never really sounds good when people say we're millennials.
Well, it is interesting. It's like I'm trying to imagine old bluegrass singers, you know, doing songs like, you know, Shady Grove or John Henry talking about struggling with aging or with a changing environment.
Right. Yeah, that's a huge part of it. I think one of the most important things that we take our music for is the songwriting. And I think that it comes from a very personal place to start, but that we hope that it's universal enough that anybody can kind of resonate with it. And I think that having multiple voices singing that helps to kind of give it that gospel kind of feeling, that connectivity, that kind of that feeling that you're not alone in those feelings, and that even if it's a different story than your story, you do connect with it.
So do you guys feel like any other ghosts are traveling with you besides Paul Revere?
We've got one that comes around pretty often and likes to mess with all the electrical equipment we touch.
Really?
I'm not sure if it's a ghost or a curse or what it might be, but our luck is a little less than good when it comes to electronics.
Sean McCarthy, Max Davis, together with Griffin Sherry, are the ghosts of Paul Revere. We're going to send you off with the song Wild Child from the band's new album, Monarch. They're going to be playing at 3S Art Space tonight. That's Saturday, November 11th. You can watch a video of the band and get some details on the show at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And I said, no, you, my wild child, I love you. Be my wild child, be mine when pretty young wrecking ball.
Special thanks to Peter Biello for speaking with us about his reporting on the VA despite a nasty cold. Today's Word of Mouth was produced by Ben Henry with Taylor Quimby, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Hannah McCarthy. Maureen McMurray is director of agonizing over which workshops to attend. Music in this episode from Poddington Bear and the Ghost of Paul Revere. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Wild child, be mine. If she loves you, you let her go. And if you love her, you know she'll move slow. And your head's a stop, but your heart yells no. She'll always leave you, and this I know. And this I know, this I know, ma'am, this I know. And this I know, this I know, ma'am.